Thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from Mathematical Intelligence, What We Have That Machines Don't by Junaid Moubin. It was first broadcast live on the 22nd of September 2022. A video recording of this and many other talks hosted by Skeptics in the Pub online are still available on our YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy this podcast and thank you for your support.
Well, look, thank you for the invitation. It really is a pleasure to be here. I spend much of my time running online math circles with Simon Singh, who I'm sure many of you know. And over the past year, we've benefited enormously from the very generous time and support of a number of SITPO volunteers who have helped us figure out how to run online webinars. So there's a lovely kind of irony for me to be involved in a SITPO event this evening. So I wrote Mathematical Intelligence with a couple of aims in mind. And the first of those was to counteract some of the hype that surrounds artificial intelligence. Now, the book came out beginning of June, and wouldn't you know it, within a couple of weeks, AI hit the headlines once again. You may remember this. A Google engineer by the name of Blake Lemoine claimed that Lambda, this chatbot that Google had developed, had acquired sentience. It had feelings, and this made headlines everywhere. It was very controversial. He was very vocal in his opinions. He was suspended. Eventually, he was let go. And to me, it was a stark reminder of just how easily we overreact to the latest developments in artificial intelligence and how easily we ascribe our most human qualities to them. This is not a new phenomenon. You don't need the sophistication of Google to see this. This was happening even 50 years ago with very primitive chatbots like Eliza. Eliza was one of the very first chatbots, and it behaved in a very simple way. It just took your most recent text input and then based a response off of that, like a very annoying psychotherapist. But for all its simplicity, Eliza, too, was able to convince many people that they were conversing with a human rather than a computer. And it rather brings into question the Turing test. So Alan Turing had proposed back in 1950 a criteria for determining whether a machine-based system is truly intelligent. And he suggested that if that system can engage in a text dialogue and convince you that you were speaking with a human rather than a computer, well, that would signal a deep form of intelligence. And now we know that's not quite true, because we have this tendency to anthropomorphize our creations. I think this is a dangerous precedent, because when we do that, then we all too easily entrust these systems to make increasingly high-stakes decisions that affect our everyday lives. And that could range from how high your car insurance premium is, to who gets to go to university, whether to bomb a factory. And these decisions are made on the basis that these systems are intelligent and sentient and so on. And I see the same worrying trend play out in mathematics. Now, that's my vantage point. And as a mathematician and as an educator, I've been frustrated for a very long time at just how poorly my subject is represented, both in terms of how it's taught in schools, and also how it's portrayed in the wider media. Because for many people, this is the image of mathematics. It's a sprawling mess of symbols. And doing mathematics, being good at mathematics, boils down to being able to perform calculations and routine procedures with speed and precision. And of course, those are the skills that do come very naturally to computers. So if that's all there is to it, the game is really up. So the second aim of this book is to showcase the more creative sides of mathematics, to show that it's a subject that actually can't be so easily automated. But there is a caveat here, because just as we have this tendency to exaggerate the capabilities of AI, it's also fair to say that occasionally we underestimate them. So you may know that back in 2016, there was a landmark moment in AI when Google DeepMind's AlphaGo program defeated the 18-time Go champion Lee Sedol. And this was really quite stunning, because by this point, computers had already outperformed humans in chess. But it turned out that with chess, you could apply brute force search techniques. And that's what IBM's Deep Blue did when it beat Kasparov back in the 90s. But if you've played Go, you'll know that it's far more complex than chess. Many more possible moves. It won't yield to brute force search. And so people thought on the whole that it would take decades, maybe even a century, before computers outperformed humans. And then AlphaGo came along and emphatically defeated CDON. And it wasn't just the scoreline, but also the way in which it played. It played moves that really wowed the Go aficionados. Now, computers have marched on since then. By now, humans have no chance at all of even getting close to winning a single game of Go against a computer. And that prompted Seedol to retire. He said, AI is an entity that cannot be defeated. So I have to look at this as a mathematician and take pause and ask whether my claims are premature, whether maths may go the same way. And so I want to be very careful in understating my claims. The first is that I do believe, and I hope to persuade you of this, that maths as a discipline is more resilient to the threats of automation, that there is more to the subject than just mastering any single set of rules, that maths, contrary to the public view, isn't so constrained. It's actually a subject that lends itself to constant reinvention. And in fact, as these technologies evolve, it gives us an opportunity to expand our mathematical horizons and our ways of thinking. But I will be careful not to make any fundamentalist claims. I won't at any point suggest what computers may or may not eventually be able to do. I will call out what I see as some of the limits of present-day approaches to AI, and in particular this dominant approach of machine learning, which has its basis in pattern recognition. But my aim here is not to define any potential end state of computers. Rather, it's to focus on humans. It's to articulate a version of our human intelligence. Now, there is a plurality to that, and my scope is very modest. My remit stretches only as far as mathematics. But at least in doing that, there is a hope that I'll raise the bar so that when those claims are made around machine intelligence or sentience or whatever else, then we have these very concrete benchmarks to test those claims against, and we're not so easily fooled. So over the next 40 minutes or so, I want to just hone in on a couple of these aspects of mathematical intelligence that I think play to our human strengths, and I think all of us, mathematicians and non-mathematicians alike, ought to embrace. So we'll start with reasoning, and at the heart of mathematics is patterns. Mathematicians are often described as pattern sniffers. I often tell my students that we're training them to become pattern sniffers. So see if you can sniff out the pattern that emerges here. I'm going to show you a series of objects. Put on your prediction hat, see if you can figure out what's going on. We start off nice and simple with a circle. And I place a point on the circumference, and I'm just going to keep track of the number of regions inside the circle. Just one so far, but let's make things a little more interesting. Let's add a second point to the circumference, join those two points up, and now we see that we've divided the circle into two regions. And if I add a third point to the circumference, join them all up, now we have four regions inside our circle, and you may see where this is going. If we add the fourth point to the circumference and join them all up, how many regions do we have this time? And if you thought eight, then well done, you can count them all up. There are eight regions inside that circle, and by now you've probably figured out the pattern. We've gone from one region to two to four to eight, and so when we add the fifth point to the circumference, I'm sure you've got it, there will be 16 regions in the circle. And again, you can count them all up. So this is really the whole, this is the nature of mathematical discovery. We study objects, we find these patterns, and then we go ahead and verify them. So we can check the next iteration along. We'll add a sixth point to the circumference. We'll join up all the points, we'll add up all the regions, and I'm sure we're all expecting to see 32 regions, and yet it turns out there are 31 regions. I was incredulous when I first saw this, didn't quite believe it, but you can see it for yourself. Do a double, triple take. There are, in fact, 31 regions rather than 32. So what's going on? Well, when we take a step back, we realize there was actually no rhyme or reason behind the pattern that we sniffed out. I'm sure we all fell for it. I certainly did. When you saw the number of regions doubling from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8, it looked like we had a pattern in our grasp, and that we'd landed on some grand truth, only to be betrayed at the sixth iteration. Now, there is a mathematical explanation that does account for how the number of regions develops, and I won't go into the details, except to say that it has nothing to do with doubling. It's a pure coincidence that for the first five iterations, it matches up with the doubling sequence. Now, this is a cautionary tale of data-driven prediction, of relying solely on patterns in numbers and data to form our beliefs. And I can play this game all day long with mathematics. Maths is very fun in this regard. There are all manner of claims that lead you down the garden path, leading you to believe that you stumbled on some discovery only to be betrayed. So here's another claim. I can claim to you that this expression, n squared plus n plus 41, is a prime number. Whatever value of n you plug in, let's say a whole number value that's not negative, plug that in, and I claim that this will give you a prime number. Primes, remember, are those numbers that can't be broken down into smaller factors. They only have two factors, themselves and one. So you try it. You try n equals 0. That gives you 41. That's a prime. Try n equals 1. That gives you 43. That's a prime. Try anything. Try n equals 5. You get 71, I think. That's a prime. Try n equals 10. You get 151. And that's a prime. So it feels, as you go through these cases and build up the evidence, that you're on your way to discovering something of real mathematical importance. But you ought to be slightly skeptical, because if there's one thing to know about prime numbers, it's that they are decidedly mysterious and shady, not very predictable. So it would be astonishing if such a simple formula could generate a whole infinitude of them. And it turns out that the pattern does break down, and you have to get to the 40th iteration. When you plug in n equals 40, you no longer get a prime. You do all the way up to that point, and then suddenly the pattern breaks down. And you can verify that for yourself. And I'll just share one more example to show you just how dramatically misleading these patterns can be. This one is slightly more technical. If I give you these two expressions, n to the power of 17 plus 9 and n plus 1 to the power of 17 plus 9, I could claim that they are relatively prime, which means the only factor they have in common is 1. That's slightly technical, but the important thing is that it always seems to hold. And in fact, I would wager that whatever value, any whole number value of n you can conceive of, this would be true for. And the reason I have confidence in that is because the smallest counterexample where this abruptly breaks down is this. A number so offensively large that I can't even pronounce it. Now, these are mathematical examples, but of course, they don't have to be, because this really speaks to our human nature, this tendency that we have to get drawn into false patterns. And in fact, there's a name for this. We all suffer from this phenomenon known as apophenia. This desire that we have to find meaning in things leads us to patterns and structures and connections that aren't really there. Humans, it turns out, are natural storytellers, but we tend to focus on the stories that give us the most palatable conclusions, whether or not they're true. We are not these cold, calculating, rational agents that are always seeking the truth, but rather we reason at the whim of our emotions and our beliefs. And in fact, we'll work very hard to build protective fences around our belief systems, predetermined belief systems, which is what psychologists call motivated reasoning. And even when it appears that we're thinking through things dispassionately, it's very hard for us to escape the most subtle biases in the thinking and decision-making. Daniel Kahneman has probably done more than most to highlight some of those issues with our thinking. He's spoken of dual processing theory, this idea that we have two modes of thinking. There's system one thinking, which is very quick. It authors many of our rapid-fire intuitions that leads to so many of these subtle errors in thinking. And then there's system two, which is a bit more careful and considered, but is very easily overwhelmed by system one. And there are suggestions that this is an evolutionary necessity, that we've evolved to develop arguments, not arguments that optimize for the truth, but arguments that are persuasive enough to convince others of our own beliefs, even if that comes at the expense of the truth. Now, I could go on in highlighting all the different flaws in human thinking, but already it's a pretty grim picture. And so it is tempting to think that we ought to just hand over the responsibility for thinking and decision-making to computers, because on the surface, they are, after all, cold and calculating rational thinking systems. Except it's not as straightforward as that, is it? Because many technologies that we develop end up inheriting our own human biases. And never is that more true than of machine learning, which is the dominant approach to AI today. And it has proven itself to be incredibly effective and versatile across a whole range of applications. At the core of machine learning is pattern recognition. Now, we all have some experience of this in our math lessons at school. You may remember drawing lines of best fit. You have these scatter plot of these various data points, and you have to find a line, you draw a line that approximates those points as closely as possible. And then the idea is that you use that line to make predictions about points that are outside of your sample. Now, of course, machine learning is more complex than this. It usually involves billions of parameters. The models are a lot more complex. But at its heart is this idea of finding patterns in very large data sets, fitting curves into those data clouds, and then using those curves to form their beliefs and to make predictions. And the danger with that is that if that data is problematic, if it's incomplete, or if it's contaminated with some bias, then those models will end up amplifying our own human bias. And the example I'll give here is a CV scoring algorithm that Amazon developed. So I guess they figured they wanted to streamline their recruitment process. And rather than manually checking the CVs of candidates, they created this language model that automatically processed new CVs and then assigned a score. And the model that algorithm was based on took its training data as all of the past hires of Amazon. Now, what they realized along the way was that this algorithm was unduly penalizing women candidates. If there was any indication at all in the CV that the candidate was a woman, if they cited attending a women's chess club, or that they were a member of a women's football team, they'd be given a lower score. Our lionesses would not fare well in this process. Now, I think it's fair to say that that bias wasn't explicitly coded in the algorithm. There are many ethical qualms that one can have with regards to Amazon, but they probably wouldn't go that far. What was probably happening, what was actually definitely happening, was that because that model was trained on their historical recruitment data, it had picked up this imperceptible gender bias that gave preference to males over females in the past. And that was now threatening to perpetuate that trend. Now, to their credit, Amazon pulled this algorithm before it went live, which is a good reminder of how important it is to keep a human in the loop of these systems. And what I will say for humans is that we do at least have some metacognitive awareness. We can think about our ways of thinking. We can learn about how we learn. And we can then, once we recognize that we have these deficits in our ways of thinking, we can think about ways of strengthening our arguments and overcoming bias. Now, I will not suggest that there is a silver bullet for that, because these biases are so pervasive. But we do have tools, and this is where I believe mathematics really shines as a discipline, because it offers us exactly this, an instrument for separating misleading patterns from truly meaningful ones. And that is the instrument of mathematical proof. So a proof is a mathematician's craft. It's a style of argumentation that is predicated on unflinching rigor and logical precision. It accounts for every assumption, every leap of logic, and the promise for a mathematician is that anything, any truth that they establish through this mechanism of proof will stand for all of time. It is beyond dispute, and it's highly sought after. Now, there are many proofs out there, and the one I want to show you is one of my own personal favorite, and it will illuminate why mathematicians argue in this way. So, as I said earlier, we're constantly sniffing out patterns, and I'm going to show you another one. And this one also involves numbers. Oh, that's a nice meme, by the way, that just demonstrates how proud mathematicians are in the uncompromising rigor that they apply to their arguments. This the in-joke here relates to the unproven Riemann hypothesis. But let me go to this worked example of a proof which involves numbers, and it involves odd numbers. You may find yourself playing around with odd numbers. Mathematicians do that kind of thing. And you may start to add them together. So you take the first odd number, then you add the next one along, you get 4. You add the next one along, you get 9. You add the next odd number along, you get 16. You add the next one along, you get 25. And then you take a breath, and you may be curious at this point, because there is a pattern that seems to speak to us, which is that whenever we sum the odds in this way, starting from one, we always seem to end up with a square number. Those numbers that you get when you multiply a whole number by itself. So 25 is 5 times 5, 16 is 4 times 4, and so on. That is curious, because we started off summing the odd numbers. That is an exercise in arithmetic, and it seems that we've ended up in the realm of geometry with these squares. So what's going on there? What's that connection? Now, there is a danger here that we fall for a false pattern. We wouldn't want to do that again. And so now we can think about what a proof would look like. And there are many different representations we can use. I'm going to go for one that I think is particularly illuminating. And since we're dealing with squares, we can think about visualizing these quantities as square arrays of dots. So here is one dot. And now I'm going to add three dots, and I can see now how that shapes up as a square. And then I add the next five along, and we can literally see the contribution it makes to then form the next square along. Add the next odd number, you get the next layer of that square, and we can see that this pattern will continue forever and more. Whichever odd number we, or whenever we add the next odd number along, it will correspond to the next layer of that square. And we know now, looking at this visual proof, that that pattern will continue forever. That is a bona fide mathematical truth. And we can meticulously lay out those lines of reasoning, but there is a level of conviction now that we can have that was lacking earlier. That is the unflinching rigor that I spoke of. And I think there is something satisfying in this proof, admittedly a subjective claim, but mathematicians often speak about elegance. They often speak about the wider themes that their proofs elucidate. In this case, we can now see visually this connection between summing the odds and squares. It's just a lot clearer now. Many mathematicians have mused on the importance of beauty in mathematical proofs. G.H. Hardy, the 20th century Cambridge mathematician, he argued that beauty is the first criteria for mathematics. He went further. He said, there is no permanent place in the world for ugly mathematics. And that's a good juncture to now think about computers and what role they can play in this whole enterprise of mathematical proof. Because undoubtedly, even today, computers can generate mathematical proofs. And there are a couple of approaches to this. The first that I'll describe, it's called the formalist approach. And the idea is that if we think of maths as a giant board game, and we then take all of the ground truths, the rules of the game, if you like, all of the ground truths, the axioms of mathematics, all of the rules of inference, and we encode them in a language that a computer can process, well, then maybe we can develop algorithms that could automatically combine those statements, those ground truths, and maybe produce more statements. In other words, we can automate the whole process of mathematical discovery and dish out proofs on a kind of assembly line. This is starting to happen. There are many such projects underway. And I'm just going to show you a couple of examples of what these proofs look like. This is from a particular database called Mizar. I won't go into the details of what this says, but what I want to highlight is the style of proof. These computers did not get Hardy's memo. They don't care very much about illuminating why the themes or elegance or beauty or any of that. There is a bluntness to this style of proof. It is heavily laden in syntax. In fact, that's the only language that these programs will process. And so I can imagine a future where computers and humans are proving theorems alongside each other. In fact, there will come a point, I'm sure, where a computer beats a human to the punch. But there may still be a role for humans to then dive into these proofs, comb through every detail, not only to make sense of them, but to try to then extract the big ideas, the insights, the things that make them so elegant that computers are paying very little attention to. But it doesn't end there, because that might suggest that computers are not capable of creative expression. And yet we are seeing examples in other arenas where that's simply not the case. So a few months ago, OpenAI, one of the big AI companies, released DALL-E 2, which is a very novel large language model. And the novelty comes in that it's a text-to-image program. So you input a piece of text, And this model has been trained on huge data sets to pick out patterns in text and figure out how to render them as images. And one of the really amazing things here is that these programs do not simply pick out these images from a stockpile, but they actually construct them from scratch. Now, you can sign up to DALL-E. I think there's a short wait list. But even if you just go on the homepage, you can find some of these archetypal examples. So here is an astronaut riding a horse in a photorealistic style. Here it is in the style of Andy Warhol. Here it is as a pencil drawing. Or let's look at teddy bears shopping for groceries in ancient Egypt. Let's look at a bowl of soup. Looks like a monster made out of plasticine. Why not? This is impressive stuff, undoubtedly, and it is forcing us to examine our notions of creativity, and it is encroaching on the work of human artists. And so you look at these examples, and you have to wonder, as I do, as a mathematician, whether the same might eventually become true of mathematics, whether we can train these large language models on human-generated mathematics and train them how to produce elegant, beautiful mathematics, whatever that means. And there are some indications that this might be possible. So I'll move over to another program now. This is called Minerva, developed by Google. And Minerva is very interesting. It has been trained on a collection of high school maths problems. It's given the problems and the solutions. And then, again, by studying the patterns in those data sets, it has been able to then very effectively answer a whole bunch of new questions that it's never seen before. And it's performing about as well as a talented high school student. What's interesting to me, looking at some of these examples that you can access on the Minerva site, is when you look at these, so you can see it answers questions across a whole range of topics. And if you look at this example from algebra, that's the kind of question that you'll find in most math textbooks. But what I find interesting is if you look at the model answer, what the model produces, that could now easily be mistaken for a solution written by a high school student. Those formalized programs earlier, they would fail the Turing test because a mathematician will easily tell them apart from human-generated mathematics. But now we have a style of argumentation and reasoning that appears to be that of a human. Now, it'll be very interesting to see the direction of travel here. We're seeing similar models emerge with undergraduate-level maths. Who knows where that ends? But it is instructive to look at some of the errors that these systems make, because they all make mistakes. And one of the things I really admire about the Minerva project is, unlike many of the other AI systems, it's very transparent about its mistakes. So it actually publishes all of the problems that it's tackled, including the ones that it got wrong. And I'm just going to skip to one of those problems. So this is a very basic arithmetic problem. It's just asking you to multiply a whole bunch of fractions. And remember that Minerva hasn't been explicitly told the rules of arithmetic, like a calculator would be. The hope is that by studying enough mathematics, enough examples of human-generated mathematics, it would learn those kinds of rules. And yet it can't handle a basic arithmetic problem like this. It starts off okay, but I think it's about here, the second step, where the wheels come off. And so this is a very strange thinking entity. If I was to analogize and think of this as a student, it'd be a very problematic student, a student that seems to show good aptitude across a range of tasks and is able to answer a number of questions, but then occasionally makes these inexplicable errors that would make me as a teacher wonder whether there is a real degree of comprehension and understanding underneath the hood, or whether they're really just winging it and fluking their way to correct answers. And now maybe that's a little harsh, but it is worth saying that these errors are not limited to Minerva. You'll see them everywhere. So DALL-E 2, in fact, I'll come back to DALL-E 2, but let me go to GPT-3, which is another large language model. This one was released by OpenAI. And it's very impressive. Again, it will fool many people into thinking that they're conversing with a human. And I've had many text exchanges with GPT-3. It's very fun. And I thought I would try to I'd pose this question because this is a very interesting problem. It arose in a 1987 study with school children, and see if you can solve it. Turns out a majority of school children will give you a nonsensical answer. They will combine those two numbers in some way. They will perform a calculation, assuming that it will lead to a sensible answer. And I'm sure you've all concluded that this, that the premise of this question isn't really sound. The information, the numbers provided, bear no relevance to the age of the shepherd. And yet a majority of school children will say that the shepherd is 25 because they'll divide one by the other. Or they may even suggest that he's 120 or 120, even 625. There's just this impulse that we have to mindlessly perform calculations, which by itself isn't an intelligent activity. So I give this question to GPT-3, and this is how it responds. It gives me an answer, and I ask for its reasoning, and you can see it very quickly gets tied up in knots. And that's a reminder to me to just be slightly cautious when interpreting the degree of intelligence or indeed sentience that these systems have. As long as they're making these inexplicable errors, I think that caution is prudent. And I'm going to show another couple of examples now. Let's go back to DALL-E 2, which is undeniably very impressive. But it turns out DALL-E 2 also has some fundamental gaps in its understanding. So, for example, it really struggles with relational knowledge, understanding how objects are situated relative to one another. If you feed it this prompt here, this is inspired by Gary Marcus, the AI researcher, a green box sitting on a red ball. I put this prompt in the other day, and this is what it comes up with. You can see it's kind of halfway there, but hasn't fundamentally grasped the semantics of this very basic prompt. Now, there is a belief that this is only a question of scale, that as long as the models are large enough and as long as we pump enough data into them, then all of this stuff will come out in the wash. They will stop making these kinds of errors. And all of these aspects of intelligence, common sense, reasoning, and everything else will naturally emerge as long as the models are large enough. I am doubtful of that claim on the basis of two things. The first is it says nothing of that data. If that data is unclean and unfiltered, well, it can lead to a misshapen and distorted worldview. We saw that earlier with the Amazon CV algorithm. And we'll see it again now because I wanted to get DALL-E's take on how it envisioned a mathematician. And I tried this with DALL-E Mini, which is a light version of DALL-E. And you can see its take on a historical mathematician. And I can assure you that while that captures some of the history of maths, the history of maths is far more diverse than these pictures would have you believe. But that's probably a faithful representation of the data that they've been trained, that system has been trained on. What's more worrying is when I ask for the rendering of a modern mathematician, what do you get? Much the same, still very hopelessly tied to those tropes. It's worth saying I tried the same thing on Stability AI, which has come out in the last few weeks, a very exciting rival to DALL-E 2. And we're going to hear a lot more about it. Here is Stability AI's take on a modern mathematician, which I think counts as a slight improvement, but still work to be done. So I'm not convinced it's a question of how much data or how large these models are, because that says nothing of the quality of that data. And then my second cause for doubt is that in all of my experience as a former mathematician, working with mathematicians, seeing some of the brightest minds at work, what I found time and time again is that the most original mathematics not only requires a degree of understanding and comprehension that is sometimes found wanting in these systems, but it has to go beyond mimicry. The best mathematicians don't simply absorb historical proofs and then replicate the techniques. That is part of what they do. But the best mathematicians are the ones that can go beyond and actually find novel strategies that hadn't been considered hitherto. And that, I think, does represent a higher bar. Now, having said that, we're very early on in this journey. It'll be interesting to see what possibilities lie ahead. I can imagine hybrid systems emerging where maybe one system learns how to create these human-like arguments and another system learns how to formalize those arguments and then automatically check them. We'll see where that goes. But for now, I just want to turn to another aspect of mathematical intelligence, which I call imagination. And I want to return to this analogy of maths as a board game, because I do think it's slightly problematic. If maths is a board game, it's a very strange one. It's a board game that actually rewards you for breaking the rules over and over again. If there is a board game like it, it's probably Monopoly. because I've played this game countless times, and every time I do play, it feels like we're playing according to different rule sets. There's all kinds of disputes that unfold. There's the free parking rule. Do you put the cash back in the bank, or does it go on free parking? But the origins of Monopoly are actually quite interesting. The original designer, Elizabeth McGee, she proposed two rule sets. It was called the Landlord's Game. And one of the rule sets, it was what we now know as Monopoly. But the idea was that as a player, you choose whether you want to play according to the Monopolist rule set, where the aim is to bankrupt your opponents, or a second rule set, which was a lot more cooperative in nature. The goal was very much geared towards a collective wealth creation. And there were elements like a land tax that were designed to expose the injustices of concentrated property ownership. And in the end, the Monopolist rule set prevailed. But it is a good reminder that the rules that we play our games by, the rules that we live our lives by, are often arbitrary, and that it is in our human nature to tinker with those rules and examine the consequences. And it turns out that mathematical discovery depends on that aptitude. Contrary to what many people think, maths doesn't boil down to a fixed set of rules. So if you have any designs on creating a mathematical system, you have to specify your ground truths up front. You have to bootstrap your system. And mathematicians refer to these as axioms or postulates. You have these postulates, you have your rules of inference, and then you let logic take its course and you go about proving your derived truths. The question then is, what do you take as your ground truths? Well, one of the first people to try this about 2,500 years ago was Euclid in ancient Greece. He built up a system of geometry and he specified five of these postulates. Now, they are all very straightforward. One of them says that if you have two points in space, there's a line that connects them. That's easy. Another one says that you can extend that line in both directions. Who would argue with that? So all of these postulates are really beyond contention. And from those five postulates, over 13 volumes, he proves over 430 theorems, starting with very basic constructions and then obviously going on to more complicated stuff. But the idea is that he can trace all of them back to those five postulates. Now, he was slightly troubled by the fifth of those postulates. It's sometimes called the parallel postulate. And then, surprise, surprise, it postulates the existence of parallel lines. It says if you have a line and you take any, like the line L, and you take any point off of that line, then there is a unique parallel line that goes through the goes through your point, a line that's parallel to the original. Bit of a mouthful, but hopefully that's common sense. And in fact, it's equivalent to saying the angles in a triangle add up to 180 degrees. We learned that in school. It's beyond dispute. And Euclid didn't doubt that. His issue was that he just felt that he ought to be able to derive this postulate from the others. He shouldn't have to rely on this one as a self-evident truth. And that way his system would then be traceable to four postulates rather than five. But he never quite managed that. And others came after Euclid and they also tried and failed to demonstrate that the fifth postulate follows from the other four. And the reason they fail is that, however obvious it seems, it doesn't. It doesn't follow, which really then makes you wonder, what other geometries are there that do not permit unique parallel lines? And to answer that, we're going to solve a riddle. You may have seen this before. This is my version of it, which unsurprisingly involves a mathematician. And they walk 1 mile south, 1 mile east, and 1 mile north, and they end up right back to where they started, which just doesn't seem possible. And then maybe the giveaway is that they see a bear. And the question then is, what color is the bear? And you probably figured out the geography of this, which is that they start and finish at the North Pole. The answer is white because they see a polar bear. But the mathematics of this, the geometry is quite interesting because that journey is actually the journey of a triangle, but not just any old triangle. That mathematician in that journey takes two 90-degree turns. So we have a triangle that has at least two 90-degree angles. In fact, if it's large enough, it'll have three 90-degree angles. And the point is that we now have a triangle where the angles add up to more than 180 degrees. That violates what we said earlier. So what's going on? Well, it turns out that Euclid's five postulates all work perfectly well on a flat surface. You get your unique parallel lines. You get angles in a triangle adding up to 180 degrees. But now we're not on a flat surface. We're on a curved surface. We're on a sphere. And now we can conceive of a whole new geometry where now our lines correspond to all the different circles that wrap around the sphere and split it into two equal parts, all the different types of equators. And the notable thing about all of those lines is they all intersect. So there are no parallel lines in this system. And one of the consequences is that angles in a triangle add up to more than 180 degrees. And there's another extreme we can take as well. This is hyperbolic geometry. You can see it on saddle-type surfaces where every point curves outwards. And now you can have multiple parallel lines, not just one. In fact, you can have infinitely many parallel lines. And one of the consequences here is that angles in a triangle add up to less than 180 degrees. So we have three very different geometries, three fundamentally different ways of thinking about shape and space. And neither one is right or wrong. Neither one is better or worse than the other. You can make a case for all of them because they are all perfectly valid, logically valid within their own right, with respect to their own axioms. And this is how mathematics unfolds. In this case, we found three different geometrical constructs by tinkering with that very simple axiom regarding parallel lines. And to me, this signals a very particular form of creativity. So you can think of creativity in two kinds. On the one hand, there's combinatorial creativity, which asks, if you're given a set of rules, how effectively can you combine them? And we're seeing humans and computers can do very creative things in that regard. AlphaGo and AlphaZero, they play very creative games of Go. DALL-E 2 produces incredible artwork that is surely creative in that sense of the term. But here I would suggest we have a second form of creativity, what's called transformational creativity, where we're not simply absorbing a set of rules. We are stepping out of that system. We are understanding what it means to depart from those rules and to build alternative realities. Now, once again, I will not say that computers are never capable of having that within their programming, but this rule-defying nature of humans isn't currently part of the remit of machine learning. And at least now we have a very, a much more concrete sense of what we mean by creativity. And it can be seen across the whole enterprise of mathematics. Now, in the last part of this presentation, I want to actually move away from some of the adversarial framing of humans versus machines. And I appreciate the subtitle of my book doesn't do me favors here, because it isn't just a question, of what we have that machines don't. That's part of it. But the subplot that I hope has started to come through here is that once we acknowledge that computers have very specific capabilities that actually complement our own ways of thinking, well, then there's an opportunity to combine forces, to think about how we can seize upon the tools of our time to augment our own ways of thinking. That is not a new idea in mathematics. It goes back thousands of years. It was true of the abacus. This is one of the earliest forms of the abacus. Humans have 10 portable counting objects in the form of our fingers, but that means that we hit a perceptual limit very soon. But the abacus was a way of keeping track of larger quantities, and commerce came to depend on this. Later on, we developed more sophisticated tools to perform more complex calculations. Older viewers may remember the slide rule, because this was a mainstay of classrooms up until about 50 years ago. And this was invented all the way back in the 17th century. And the idea is to reduce more complex calculations down to simpler ones. It was inspired by the work of John Napier, Scottish inventor. He'd observed on his travels that merchants, navigators, astronomers, they all struggled with their day-to-day calculations. And the premise of the slide rule is that you can take a particular calculation, let's say multiplying two large numbers, and you can reduce it to a much simpler one that's less error-prone. So rather than multiplying those numbers, using this mechanism, you can reduce it to a problem that involves addition. And the same is true across a whole range of operations. Now, I referenced there the original human computers, those accounting ledgers and the astronomers, merchants, navigators, they were all relied upon to perform calculation with speed and precision. But of course, there came a point where we were done with human computers, where we outsourced that task to our electronic counterparts. And the origins story of the modern computer actually has a very close tie to pure mathematical inquiry that I think doesn't get spoken about often enough. Because about 100 years ago, a small group of mathematicians or logicians came along and asked, is it possible to devise an algorithm, an all-knowing algorithm essentially, that you would be able to feed statements into? So if you had a logical system based on a set of axioms, you would be able to specify any statement in that system, feed it into this algorithm, And then it would tell you if that statement was true or false. And if it was true, it would give you a proof. And if it wasn't true, it would say as much. So this was known as the Entscheidungs problem, the decision problem. And if there was such an algorithm, that would be bad news for mathematicians. It would reduce the whole enterprise of problem solving to just specifying these statements and then just churning them out of an algorithm. But thankfully for mathematicians, turns out there is no such algorithm. And it was the likes of Alan Turing who was motivated by this problem to actually then specify what we mean by an algorithm, what we mean by computation, and in doing so laid the foundation for modern computing as we know it today. And Turing demonstrated that there is no algorithm, that there are certain problems that evade algorithmic number crunching. And the example he came up with is one that we can all relate to. If you've ever found yourself confronting a spinning wheel on a Mac or whatever your equivalent is and your operating system of choice, well, then you'll have had to decide whether to hang around, see whether that program terminates, or whether to cut your losses and just reboot. And if you're anything like me, you'll lack patience and you'll just reboot. But there is some vindication in that, because what Turing showed is that there is no computer program, no algorithm that will tell you in general whether any other given program will continue on indefinitely or halt. That is known as the halting problem. We say it's undecidable because it cannot be solved by algorithms in general. And now there's a whole class of similar undecidable problems that we know of in maths and logic and computer science, which I think is good news for mathematicians. It suggests that there's a degree of novelty and ingenuity that's needed. And when the computer was realized later on, after Turing, mathematicians didn't hesitate to put it to use. And there was a seminal moment in 1974 when a computer for the first time was recognized as making a major contribution to a mathematical proof. And it was the proof of a really lovely theorem. It's called the four-color theorem. So get your crayons out for this one, because it says that you can color any map with four colors in such a way that no two neighbors share the same color. So no two neighbors share the same color. You can do it with four colors. You can do it for the UK. In fact, the theorem says you can do it with any conceivable map. It's an astonishing claim when you think about all the possible map configurations. And it was first stated in the mid-19th century. And then it about 100 years passed, and it proved too thorny for mathematicians. But along came two of them. Kenneth Appel and Wolfgang Haken in 1974, they announced a proof, and it came in two parts. Because in the first part, they managed, using an ingenious argument, to reduce it down to about 2,000 of these maps. But these were still very messy configurations that would take a human years to check through with no guarantee of accuracy. And so they brought in a computer to check through those remaining cases, which it did in a matter of days with a guarantee of accuracy. Human-machine collaboration in action with a very clear division of cognitive labor, each one doing what they do best. Now you fast forward to the present day, and we've seen that computers can do a lot more than just crunch through numbers. And about a year ago, there was a very interesting example coming out once again from Google's DeepMind. They announced a collaboration with a small number of pure mathematicians, where they used some similar programs to AlphaZero, the programs that had proven so effective in those games. They used those same pattern recognition tools to train them on these very abstract problems in maths. So one of these problems involves knots. Mathematicians enjoy studying knots and the different properties they have. And in this particular study, a human mathematician prepared a data set of around 3 million of these knots, very carefully labeled. They handed that over to DeepMaths, the name of the program, and DeepMaths found these patterns that had previously eluded the human mathematicians, but when they were alerted to them, they were only too glad. They studied those patterns, they refined their intuitions, they proved new theorems. This is, and always has been, the direction of travel, that as technology evolves, human mathematicians can work alongside them to enhance their own ways of thinking. That, I believe, is the spirit of human-machine collaboration, a more optimistic outlook that I think we can all embrace. And I just want to conclude, if I may, with one final defense of mathematics, because by now you're surely persuaded that the future bodes well for mathematicians, but what about the rest of us who don't actually do mathematics for a living? And I would suggest that the whole framework of mathematical intelligence, my motivation for writing this book, is that it's relevant to all of us, because mathematics, I truly believe, is one of the most powerful and accessible thinking systems that we've ever developed. And one of the best analogies that I've come across from Eugenia Cheng, another mathematician, is that it's a form of high altitude training for the mind, because even engaging in these abstract problems conditions us to think and reason with unflinching rigor, to examine every assumption, to account for every leap of logic. And in this world where we're now saturated with mistruths and half-truths, I think mathematics can be a wonderful training ground to make perennial skeptics of us all. And the real benefit of studying proofs is that they can alert us to non-proofs, to the most subtle flaws in everyday thinking and decision-making. And I will leave you with this. I'm going to show you something, because this will take us through the break, that is just patently absurd. You won't believe your eyes, but the burden of proof is on you to expose what's really going on here. So here we go. You have two shapes, two triangles that appear to be the same. There's four parts of the configuration, and they've just been rearranged. And yet one of the squares is unaccounted for. It's gone. And now we all have to play the role of skeptic. We have to ask where that square has gone, because surely we're not going to accept that as a premise. And you may not get it right away. I can assure you, you do not need advanced mathematics to figure this one out, but you may need to take a step back, examine your assumptions, ask yourself what you're seeing, and eventually it will come to you. And maybe we'll get there in the Q&A. So I will finish on that note, except to say thank you for your attention and look forward to the Q&A.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to Skeptics in the Pub Online. I can see that during the break, you've been very busy asking questions that our speaker this evening is going to now answer for you. So please welcome back to the chat and to the stream our speaker, Junaid Mabeen. Junaid, thank you so much for a fascinating talk. I can see the chat are really interested. They've been really excited, especially about the puzzle that you shared with us right at the end, which I think we can bring back up on screen now, if we can just pull that up. And so I believe the question we had here is essentially we can see that all the pieces fit together to make triangle A, but exactly the same pieces moved into slightly different positions suddenly have a spare square for triangle B. And so rather than answer that right now, we're going to answer that at the end of the Q&A. So we're going to leave you all in even more suspense. But those of you who are trying to figure out this puzzle at home, you can have another quick look at it now and see if you can spot anything that's going on. And actually, how about we leave it up while we answer the first question? And that will give people a bit of time to spend some time on this. And the first question is from an anonymous questioner who asks, I've heard stories about people visualizing an abacus in order to do huge calculations very quickly. Is that true? And if so, how the hell they do it?
It's undoubtedly true. I don't know that those specific cases, but there are so many different accounts of people who calculate in the most amazing ways. And some of these people are what you may call neuroatypical. And so they just have very quirky ways of thinking. But actually, quite often it's just the way that we're educated, and actually sometimes it's just the way that we're naturally exposed to numbers in our environment. There's this fascinating study with fruit sellers in Brazil, and these are children that are dropped out of school, so they didn't have formal education, and if you gave them a school maths test, they did fail it in this study. But then they gave them a bunch of arithmetic questions. They gave the same questions to a bunch of school children. And it turns out the fruit sellers outperformed the school children. And it's because the school children were very fixed in their methods, what they picked up in school. And so any question that had any degree of novelty, they struggled with, or perhaps they had the rounding errors. Whereas the fruit sellers had to rely on very creative approaches to arithmetic, because they depend on it in their day-to-day trade. And so they're having to innovate as a matter of necessity to come up with reliable calculations in a very short amount of time, because their commerce depends on it. And so there's an example there of how we are very adaptable. When we think about how we study numbers, how we learn how to compute numbers, there's far more to it than any prescribed method would have you believe.
Well, I think picking up from that is another anonymous question. And this question is a bit more complex than simple arithmetic. But what would be your response to the people who say that their time was wasted learning calculus and similar at school because they never use it in adult life?
I sympathize. It's hard to disagree because what they've learned in school, and I studied this at school too, isn't really the concepts of calculus, which are deeply profound. I mean, being able to understand how to analyze things at an infinitesimally small scale and then applying that to physical problems, applying that to a whole range of problems, it's an incredible framework to have. But what do they teach us in school? It's not the concepts of calculus. It's a whole litany of methods. Here's the rule for differentiating this. Here's the rule for integrating that. So if that's what you mean by the calculus that you've taught at school, I would agree that it's probably not very useful. It's the kind of thing that you can stick into Wolfram Alpha or, you know, any basic computing tool today, and it will do it for you. And there's a very basic extent to which it helps to be able to perform those computations. But calculus and mathematics as a whole isn't about computation. It's about ideas. It's about concepts. And there are so many fascinating things to study in calculus that just don't get taught in school. Not because they're too advanced, but because they're not easily measurable. They're not as easy to test. And that's usually what gets privileged in the curriculum.
Yeah, yeah. No, that sounds like it makes a lot of sense.
Recommendation off the back of that. Infinite Power, Stephen Stobratz. Thank me later.
Gotcha. And now going even more complicated in terms of the type of math that we're talking about, P. Landry Seal asks, how long do humans have to prove the Riemann conjecture before it becomes improbable that the proof, if ever will be found, could be found by a human? So do we let humans carry on cracking at the Riemann conjecture, or do we let the accept that if it's going to be found, it's going to be AI and computers?
Humans will never give up. And that's because we'll look back on other examples where common sense may have dictated that we should give up, and yet we prevailed. So, Marsh, you and I both know Simon Singh very well. He wrote a bestseller called Fermat's Last Theorem. And the reason it's a bestseller is because it's an enthralling account of a 342-year journey to prove a theorem, Fermat's Last Theorem. I won't go into the details, except that it baffled mathematicians, the best mathematicians. And if you think about that particular 350 years, we're talking some of the best mathematicians that have ever lived. It would be very tempting to think, if you were living in the mid to late 20th century, that you should just give it up. Andrew Wiles, I think as a 10-year-old, finds that problem in a book somewhere and is so enchanted by it that he decides that he's going to make it his life's purpose to find a proof. And indeed he does when he's a bit older. And so I think there's just a deep curiosity that will always drive us, whether we're working with computers or whatever, will never give up the game. And so I would never want to declare that the game is up. Having said that, I refuse to project if and when the Riemann hypothesis will be proven, because it has been a while. It's known to be particularly thorny. And I guess it's one of those things that you wonder if you're going to see in your lifetime. And I guess it's also one of those things that we're now starting to wonder is going to be proven by humans or computers.
Hmm. Well, if you're not willing to predict when on the Riemann conjecture, then perhaps we can get you to do some predicting with Igor's question, because Igor asks, what will be the future of mathematics? If AI isn't going to completely take over the field, surely it's going to at least change the way, or it should at least change the way that we do maths right now.
It certainly ought to change the way that we teach maths in school, where we should be putting these tools in front of children and showing them what they can do with them. And for mathematicians too, I shared the example of Deep Maths, which is a contemporary collaboration between DeepMind and pure mathematicians. And the reason they work with pure mathematicians is to demonstrate that some of these technologies can take aim at even the most abstract areas of math. And I think as things evolve through the range of approaches that I spoke about, we are going to see theorems that increasingly computers make a contribution to, that they even prove ahead of humans. But the good news about mathematics is that it is infinitely vast. And in the spirit of breaking the rules, we can constantly shift the goalposts. It may feel like a cop-out, but we can keep redefining mathematics as the bit that computers can't do yet. And one thing that mathematicians have a real talent for above anything else is the ability to ask interesting questions. And just as when computers triumphed in chess, we moved along to Go. I think in mathematics, the more computers demonstrate, the more mathematicians will be inspired to define or redefine the boundaries of the kinds of questions that are worth asking.
Gotcha. So that kind of takes us into a question from Paul or Picticule, who asks, do you think AI is going to get there eventually, or do you think it's fundamentally flawed and destined to ultimately fail? I guess in the question of replacing mathematicians and doing maths just as well as humans can.
So I am, to a degree, skeptical about today's predominant approach to AI, which is machine learning. It's undoubtedly very successful, and there's no point denying that. But I'm doubtful on account of the fact that, firstly, a lot of it seems to be driven by commercial interests rather than pure scientific inquiry. And so I'm doubtful that it's going to confront the hardest questions that it could conceivably do, when a lot of these problems can be solved at a surface level through pattern recognition. And that's true in mathematics and more broadly. But I'm also just doubtful that intelligence as a whole, mathematical intelligence in particular, boils down to absorbing large quantities of data and discerning patterns. Seems too crude to me. And I think there is a recognition emerging that we're going to need a hybrid of approaches where machine learning is part of the mix, but alongside other approaches, whether that's more traditional approaches or other approaches that are only still developing. I'm hesitant to state any fundamental limits for computers, but I think I am confident in saying that machine learning itself is going to have to hit a wall eventually, because large data, large models only go so far.
And what we're obviously talking about is artificial intelligence. We've got a couple of questions on a similar theme, where Igor says, do you think that general AI will eventually emerge from whatever we have for AI now, or will it be something else entirely? And also Garnet, on the same subject, says, do you see a lot of misunderstanding caused by the confusion between artificial intelligence and artificial general intelligence, given that AI is coming on in leaps and bounds, whereas AGI still seem to be a distant
absolutely.
Dream?
So let's clarify terms. So my understanding of AI is the ability to solve a complex problem. AlphaGo is an example of AI, and DALL-E is another example of AI. Now, AGI, artificial general intelligence, is when you have a system that can accomplish a whole range of tasks as well as a human, and that suggests a degree of versatility, a degree of roundedness, a degree of immersion in the real world that allows a single system to navigate its way around. And I think at the moment what we're seeing is a hodgepodge of individual artificial brains, artificial neural networks that are very impressive and capable within a very narrow arena. But the leap from there to AGI, I think, is profound. I don't believe, as I said, that machine learning is on its own the path that's going to take us there. I think it's part of the mix, just as, you know, humans on one level, we do rely on pattern recognition. But the reason I based my entire argument on mathematical intelligence is it shows us that there's so much more to intelligence than simply spotting patterns. And so I think there will have to be more to it, whether that's hard-coded symbolic reasoning or whatever else it may be. There is, of course, super intelligence as well. I see those couple of questions around the singularity and when things will basically explode all out of control. I will say that a lot of the hype at the moment seems to be driven by large language models. And I'll go back to some of my doubts around why that's the path to AGI. Firstly, the premise that you just need enough data. If that data is not fully accounted for, you know, is that the way you would educate a human child, by having them swallow the entire contents of the internet? I think you'd be quite worried about some of the beliefs that would emerge. Secondly, it all seems fairly abstract and removed from the real world. Text, a chatbot on screen. I think the more realistic prospect is to, you know, unleash a robot into the world, have it engage in authentic real-world interactions. But of course, that approach may not scale so well. Maybe there are approaches in between where you create these synthetic environments and have programs that, you know, simulate physical interaction in a real world. We're seeing increasing examples of that too. So without declaring fundamental limits, I think I'll say again, I think machine learning and in particular large language models will take us so far and give us insights into certain types of thinking, but they surely can only be part of the mix.
Yeah. Well, you touched on the singularity, which is a question that Wayne J was asking, how far away do you think the singularity is, but also asking how can we keep up or protect ourselves from spurious instantaneous annihilation? Is symbiosis the only way? Do we have to just learn to love the singularity and accept it?
I try to not engage in conversations around the singularity because it's just too speculative. The precise answer to the question is 2045, if you believe Ray Kurzweil, who wrote The Singularity Is Near and has made many forecasts, many of which, it's fair to say, are coming along nicely and some of which seem rather hyperbolic.
Just for the viewers who don't know, would you mind just defining what we mean by the singularity there, actually?
Is, interesting, there's mathematical definitions as well. I'll give you the one that I think is meant by this, which is the point where an AI can program a smarter version of itself. Because at that point, you get this exponential explosion. There's a scene in the Terminator movies when Arnie, it's my favorite movie, I have to say, the Terminator 2, and it's a scene where he's in a car explaining to Sarah Connor how the machines will basically nuke the whole world. And he describes this geometric progression of the moment when they acquire sentience and then suddenly it all goes to pot. Now, a few issues with that. It's a movie. And I don't believe in the premise that they have to acquire sentience in order to be dangerous. I think we are now seeing a decoupling between intelligence and consciousness from the whole debate around AI. But singularity is certainly this idea that intelligence just spirals out of control because you have systems that can create smarter versions of themselves. And people generally believe, I should say there are all kinds of predictions, that there are ways of keeping track of these predictions. Ray Kurzweil's 2045 one is one that many people subscribe to. They say 2029 is AGI, 2045 is superintelligence, and at that point, our best bet is to merge with them. And it's so unbelievably speculative. It feels very spiritual and cult-like to me. And so I'd rather avoid that kind of speculation. But there are reasons to have existential angst towards these technologies. But I would suggest that we don't need to take the long-term view to understand why AI might be dangerous. Just look at its present-day threats to equity, to social justice, how it's impacting on people's lives today. Now, that might not be as glamorous. It might not make for Hollywood blockbusters. But it's well worth acknowledging that these systems are pervasive today and already through mass surveillance, through the discriminatory nature of data collection and many of these algorithms, it is having adverse impacts on society today.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings us to one of Igor's many questions. They're always fantastic questions from Igor. Igor asks, do you think that big corporations are hiding their biases behind the cold algorithm, or do you think they're doing these shady things completely unknowingly? So what role are their biases and the intentions of their biases playing, do you think? It's not me, it was the algorithm.
Hide their biases behind.
Do you think they know that they have these biases?
Like, it has to be a rhetorical question, because I think the answer is so obvious. In the case of many of these companies, so Facebook and the big tech companies in particular, they know what they're doing. They know, because they are incredibly smart. They, even though they can't fully account for how these black box systems will perform, they know full well that the nature of large-scale data collection and approaching these problems through scale will inflict all kinds of side effects. And they can't plead ignorance on that, just as they can't plead ignorance on the role that their platforms have in spreading misinformation and hate. They have to accept the responsibility for the inevitable consequence of training the systems in the way that they do, which is predicated on this commercial logic of mass surveillance. Surveillance capitalism is what it's sometimes called. And that is just a very particular approach to AI that says collect as much data as you can. And we know that there are very nefarious data collection practices, let alone how the data is used. And so if we accept the premise that platforms like Facebook aren't the most transparent in how they collect your data, let's also presume that they're not completely ignorant in how that data is going to be put to use.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been a little negative on AI.
But throw any big tech company into the mix there. Facebook's one that I've just got a particular gripe with.
very fair. But for all of our viewers who did find us on Facebook, please keep doing that and please keep turning up to future talks. We've been negative on the idea of AI a little there, so let's look at the positive side of it. So Andrew K asks, when it's at its best, how can AI change our lives, even for those who've got no interest in or knowledge in AI? How can it change those lives for the better?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many positive applications of AI today. I spent 7 years working for a company in the education space called Wiz Education that uses fairly basic forms of AI to develop a virtual tutor. So it's an online fully automated tutoring program that's not as dystopian as it sounds. It's just a fun online set of maths games that students play in order to learn maths and progress through the curriculum. And the AI, if you like, comes in tracking their progress and figuring out the level of difficulty that the question should be and giving them the right lesson at the right time. And I should say that we were very ethical in our data collection, very transparent in how our algorithms worked. And that, I think, is a positive use case of AI. I saw the benefits of that firsthand, especially when those tools were put in the hands of parents and teachers who could understand how this virtual tutor could support them along their journey. There's this example that's coming out just this week of Whisper, which is a speech recognition technology, and it may give the prospect for the first time of me being able to communicate with some relatives back in Pakistan, because I don't understand Urdu any more than they understand English. But now there may be an interface where we can each speak in our native languages and it can reliably translate. That is phenomenal. And they're just two of many examples where, you know, AI will have positive impacts, but let's not allow that to blind us to its obvious toxic effects too. And in fact, even when you have these well-intentioned routes, they can quickly spiral out of control. I won't name names, except Facebook, but there are examples of companies masquerading as education providers, claiming that AI and virtual tutoring can do things that it blatantly cannot. We were always very measured at Wiz about just how far this virtual tutor could go. And so I would be cautious. Anytime you see AI doing something positive, just ask what the real motive is behind the development of those technologies. It's well worth being skeptical and cynical even, and questioning what the worst use case is, because chances are someone's probably imagined it, especially if there's a profit motive.
Yeah, yeah. I think we've got two more questions before we put people out of their misery with the puzzle that we set them. So Gray the Earthling asks, will the outputs of AI always need human review in order to be useful, do you think?
So I'll go back to the maths example where I think there will come a point in the future where you will have end-to-end proof systems, where one system, as I mentioned, will learn to generate proofs, another will learn to formalize them, and part of formalization is the ability to automatically check the logic of those proofs. And we may be forced to say, well, what's left for us humans? Because these systems now, they're generating mathematical proofs that we know are logically valid because of this automated verification process. They're actually quite nice proofs as well because of the way they've been trained to generate human-generated proof. So I think the answer is probably no. Forget the exact framing, but I think the answer is that it's not a given that humans will always need to be in the loop, depending on the context. But certainly anything that's premised on machine learning alone, pattern recognition, with the kinds of commercial applications that we see today, because the risks are so high and the scope of error and the impact that can have on people's everyday lives, because that's so severe, I feel like there's some responsibility on humans to stay in the loop, even if it becomes ever more challenging to decipher how these computers are thinking. I think we've always got to keep those inexplicable errors in mind. And, you know, a bug in a maths proof is one thing, but a bug in an autonomous weapon system is quite another. And so I think there's almost like an ethical encoding that we need. It's got to be axiomatic that humans need to accept responsibility, and part of that means staying in the loop of these things.
And we'll end the questions with a final one from Igor on a very similar theme to what you were just touching on there. Igor asks, which do you fear more, AGI destroying humanity on purpose or a stupid robot destroying the world because it had the goal to make things into paperclips?
Yeah, I had nightmares about the paperclips example. So Nick Bostrom made this famous in his book on superintelligence. So the idea here is You may have a system that has no consciousness, but is so incredibly intelligent, so good at pattern recognition, and so incredibly motivated to achieve a particular goal. So if you give it the goal of maximizing paperclips, it may interpret that as converting all the world's matter into a giant paperclip factory, and that would spell bad news for the rest of us. I'm not so worried about those sensationalist claims because it assumes so much in terms of the agency that those systems would need. And it almost seems to me like they would need a degree of consciousness or something that goes beyond pattern recognition alone. I'm maybe most concerned by selfish, stupid humans who are going to unleash these technologies prematurely, whether it's for commercial gain, whether it's for geopolitical gain, and not do the due diligence that we've been mentioning. So the stupidity of the robots may just be an inherited property of us humans.
And that is a fantastic place to end a great talk. And now, just before we wrap up, we can come back to this puzzle that you said. So we can pull the puzzle back up on screen. And Junaid, you can explain what is really going on here and where this this extra square suddenly comes from in Triangle B.
Yeah, this is my Penn and Teller moment. If you watch Fallers, when they take the hot seat and try to decipher how the magic tricks work, that's kind of what I was giving you all the opportunity to do. And there was one thing I said that wasn't quite true, that was a bit sneaky, and I said you're looking at two triangles, and that's not quite true. A is a triangle, there's no doubt about that. What's also true is I have, this is a reconfiguration of those four segments, that is true. But there is an assumption here that B is also a triangle, and that's not quite true. Because if you look at the blue segment and the red segment, they have a different slope. You can actually calculate the height over the width and verify they have a different slope. Or now that I've told you, you can probably just see that blue is slightly steeper than red. That means that B is not a triangle. And so when we're thinking about the areas of these two respective shapes, it's not a like-for-like comparison. And there's an ever-so-subtle gain that shape B makes from the rearrangement that makes up for that supposedly missing square.
There we go. So hopefully you all spotted that. And if you did,
who was a wonderful recreational mathematician, set puzzles in Scientific America, I think it was, and wrote loads of books. I think he either came up with it or he popularized it. And there's lots of fun variants on this as well. And of course, you can try this with chocolate. And if you still believe there's a missing square, you've got yourself an infinite supply of chocolate.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. For more skeptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow at SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online. where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.